This episode of the UAV Digest is sponsored by Go Engineer, provider of design, engineering, and 3D printing solutions for the aerospace and unmanned vehicles industries. To learn more, visit theuavdigest.com/goengineer. And by UAV Propulsion Tech, a provider of propulsion, servo, autopilots, and rescue and recovery parachute solutions for the unmanned aerial vehicle market. For more information, check out www.uavpropulsiontech.com. You're listening to episode 160 of the UAV Digest. I'm Max Flight in Hartford, Connecticut.
Hey, Max, it's David in Philadelphia. How are we tonight?
We're doing well. It's a Thursday again, so that's the time that you and I get on Skype and talk unmanned aircraft.
And evidently, at the beginning of the show, we had a flashback to episode 60. That was a long time ago.
That was the first version of the opening.
Who knew that we were going to be up to 160? This seems like, we've been doing this almost now. This is going to be our fourth year doing this.
It doesn't really seem like it's been that long. You think back to those early days and when we were all complaining about the slow movement of the FAA and other regulatory bodies in terms of coming up with regulations
and not using the word drone.
That's right. That was a big topic of conversation. Are we going to say drone or not?
So let's talk about moving on. To show for how far we've come, we should get CNN on and have them talk about their drone program. We've got UAS researchers working with NASA. When you go to the airport, you need to keep your drone on a leash. A police blotter and some additional tools and hardware, a video of the week, some conferences to discuss, and some feedback. So we got a bit of a full show, so I guess we should get episode 160 started. What do you think, Max? Well, our first story is sort of comes from CNN about CNN. The CNN press room blogs at CNN.com says CNN launched CNN Air. It's kind of a lot of CNNs there. What do you think, Max?
Yeah, it is sort of circular, I guess, but they've launched a new unit. It's called officially CNN Aerial Imagery and Reporting. That's how you get the air out of CNN Air. And they're starting with two full-time UAS operators who are continue to use drones for news gathering.
And we've talked about CNN before because the FAA chose them for the Pathfinder program to develop tools and procedures for using UASs for news gathering. And under that auspices, the CNN has used UASs for the current flooding in Louisiana, the Flint, Michigan water crisis, both the Republican and Democratic presidential nominating conventions, yay Philly, thank God that's over, presidential primary debates and town halls, the 50th anniversary of the Civil Rights March in Selma, Alabama, and coverage of the 10th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina. So what do you think, Max? You think CNN's being successful? Do you think we're going to start seeing other news companies officially doing it? I know NBC supposedly used a lot of drone footage in Rio, but I don't remember seeing that much on the Olympics.
No, I think we've all gotten kind of good at watching television and picking out the coverage, the videos that must have come from drones. But yeah, I don't recall a lot from the Olympics. But certainly CNN has been active out there, and not only will they be providing imagery and reporting for the CNN networks, but also Turner Broadcasting and Time Warner as well. The part about this that made me sit back a little and think is that they're starting with two full-time UAS operators. That sounds like a pretty small unit for something as large as CNN and Turner Broadcasting and Time Warner. I can envision only limited coverage via drone as they fly these two guys around the world. Either that or they really need to build up a much larger unit. That's kind of what I would think that they'd have to do.
It's interesting enough, if you really think about it, they were flying under a 333 exemption, so you need a spotter and a pilot. Hopefully the department's bigger than the two guys, because that basically eliminates, you're down to one pilot and one spotter. Now, a lot of what we talked about that they've used this for have been major events. They're not necessarily breaking news. They're, you know, pre-planned. The water crisis in Flint, Michigan lasted weeks and months. The flooding currently in Louisiana is lasting multiple weeks. And you can pre-plan and pre-flight things like primary debates and nominating conventions and civil rights marches. So you could probably get away with two people, but we'll have to see if it expands. And we'll also have to see what other news companies are going to follow suit now that the Pathfinder mission is kind of over. So interesting. Congratulations to CNN. And we should probably move on to some NASA research and UAS researching, exchanging information, which is always a good thing.
This is University UAS Researchers Share Information Network with NASA. Now, when we think about expanding use of drones in the airspace, we think of package deliveries and things like that. That all drives us towards needing a really robust drone traffic management system. And this is something that NASA has been working towards. And in fact, NASA and the FAA had earlier this year, back in April, formed a partnership. But now we see, I think, David, a next step being taken.
It's the Lone Star UAS Center of Excellence and Innovation at Texas A&M, University of Corpus Christi. And we've talked about them because they were part of one of the test sites. And they've created an interconnection security agreement. Okay, what that means is that university researchers can create directly access NASA Ames Research Center and exchange real-time UAS flight data. This sounds like DARPANET. You know what happened with DARPANET?
It became the internet.
It became the internet. For people who don't know, DARPANET was a connection of colleges and real-time study things to communicate information. So this is the internet for drones without Al Gore?
Without Al Gore. Maybe. The important thing is that when you look at drone traffic management systems, you could easily envision that requiring a lot of communication and a lot of coordination between different systems. And so a common protocol that can be used to effect these types of communications is really important. Just like, as you mentioned, David, just like was the case with the internet, where we had, you know, the IP protocol, the internet protocol, and other things that establish standards that let all these different systems work together. So we need the same thing here, and I think this is a really kind of a major step in that direction. So it's an encouraging, I think it's almost a milestone, just the fact that they've reached this agreement to interconnect in this way. Of course, what comes of it and how it develops over time is going to be critical, but I think this is a major milestone, in my opinion.
Test centers doing test centers stuff and communicating it out to people to study it across the board. Yeah, good thing.
Yeah.
Very good thing. So we've been hoping for this, and NASA Ames is leading the charge. So if they can provide the actual data and you could do real-time analysis on it, this is going to be fantastic. Okay. Every week we talk about flying drones near airports and don't do it. Well, The French firm Alistair has designed a tether drone to fly around airports. And this is from newatlas.com. Drones do mix with airports as long as they're kept on a leash. Do you always walk your drone, Max?
No. This is an interesting use of the tethering concept. They're broadly, this company is looking at tethered drones for applications that require some sort of persistent aerial operation. So it could be surveillance, it could be continuous aerial broadcasting, it could be complex inspections, industrial inspections that take time, traffic monitoring. There could be a variety of different situations where you want to have a drone up there stationary, semi-stationary for an extended period of time. And so this company has two tethered ground stations for drones, the Safe T and the High T. I think the High T is a similar concept, but sort of a ruggedized version. Of course, when you think about tethering a drone for some period of time, you need a couple of things. You need communication and you need power. And Alistair has developed a very lightweight tethering cable, wire, string, I'm not sure what you call it, that does provide communications for continuous data transfer and does provide power up to 2,500 watts at a 100-meter tether length.
Of course, if you're plugged in and you're not worrying about charging batteries, you have an unlimited flight duration. The only problem is you need to, I mean, we're talking like subs. The only problem with that is foodstuffs, but you're not worrying about running out of power on your rechargeable batteries. You keep them controlled. Now, if you've got 100 meter, which is approximately 300 feet, which is like a football field. I mean, you've got an area where you've got a control crash should something happen. You're not going to get a flyaway unless it breaks the tether. And I don't know. I mean, but we can go back to seeing J-Lens and watching that fly across the country because it broke its tether. So it's an interesting concept. We've talked about tethered UAVs before. This is interesting because really they're just coming up with the ground station and the tethering. What's really interesting is it's designed to support production UAVs.
That's right. They say on their webpage that they currently support multi-copters like the DJI S900 and the S1000, also the Unique H920, the Griffin Dynamics X8. The SkyEye Innovations and the Copter Systems POC. Also, they note in this article that the U.S. Army has ordered some of these. I can envision something like this also being very useful for military applications where you want to provide some kind of surveillance over a certain area over maybe an extended period of time.
And if you want to use it as a communication tool, there's a lot of things that you could do. I think now that we understand that tethering is not a way to avoid being part of registration with the UAVs, which we've gone through before, there's going to be a lot of interesting applications based on tethered UAVs. You know, this is really kind of cool. It's an interesting way to handle it, that you buy the UAV, then buy the separate system, and we'll have to follow up. So let's talk about some bad. Well, actually, no, I actually consider this good news. Now, I, in all fairness, folks, this is sort of on the periphery of the topic, but if I had to pick two topics that our pilot friends hate most of all, it's UAVs crashing into their windshield and laser pointers. A lot of issues with laser pointers, and it's on the periphery, but it sort of always gets mixed into news with drones. And this was from the Orange County Register, my uncle's favorite newspaper out in California. And that was, A 35-year-old Californian was sentenced to 15 months in federal prison for pointing a laser pointer at a helicopter flying over a traffic accident. I don't know of anything that's been this serious as far as laser pointers go, Max, in all of our years of discussing them on Airplane Geeks.
A lot of times, maybe most of the time, the offender is never identified, but occasionally they are, and that was the case here. And, you know, we always kind of comment on these stories hoping that it won't be just a slap on the wrist. And I think 15 months in federal prison, that's a little bit more than a slap on the wrist. So I think that's good.
We'll leave it at that. If you want to read about it, you can always look at the link in the show notes. This also article is sort of on the periphery, but we end up always talking about privacy concerns and observations. And the Airplane Geeks and myself have a friend who, by the name of Floyd, who flies helicopters and has been on the Airplane Geeks for the Baltimore Police Department. But in this case, Baltimore has been doing some other aerial surveillance without many people knowing about it. And the first one, our first article was from TechDirt.com. Baltimore Police Department can keep tabs on the entire city thanks to privately donated aerial surveillance system.
This is a product from Persistence Surveillance Systems. And this is something that has a really wide field of view and pretty good resolution considering the field of view, 192 million megapixels in this camera. And this was, I think, originally developed for use in the military to provide sort of an observation platform over a really wide area to track activities. And the Baltimore Police Department has benefited, I guess, from a donation made by some private party who purchased this device and provided it to the Baltimore PD. There are a lot of articles on this topic out there. I think the general thrust of most of them is the fact that this thing's been operating since, I think it was either January or February of this year, and it's been operating pretty much under a veil of secrecy. And people are very concerned about the fact that there's this big wide-angle imaging system overhead doing, we're not sure what.
It's doing surveillance, persistent surveillance. While you can't identify individuals, they appear as pixelated, but you can track the movement of individuals at 1.5 meter resolution. This is a pretty powerful camera, and it's an interesting topic because we talk about drones and surveillance, and in this case, it's in surveillance in the public sphere, not the military sphere. So a lot of back channels on why it's operating, how it's operating, but we do like talking about privacy, and this is one of those things where one of these cameras could be attached to a UAV and we don't know. I mean, I don't want to speculate, but it's one of those things that we should mention that it's out there.
The secrecy around this that's occurred in Baltimore and sort of the fallout from that strategy is kind of a lesson and maybe something that, you know, other agencies, police departments or otherwise need to consider, let's say, before they employ the types of surveillance tools that you can with drones now. The good applications or the good aspects of the application can be lost in the anger over people's perceptions over invasion of privacy.
And let's face it, like the old saying says, it's not the act, but it's the cover-up that will get you in trouble.
Yeah, exactly.
So, Max, we got a video of the week. I see that you threw this in the show notes. You want to talk a little bit about it?
I thought you threw this in the show notes, David.
You're right. We spend all week looking at these things, and sometimes we forget what we put in at the beginning of the week, as it's now Thursday. So, yes, you're right. This is a first-person view quadcopter that bounces off walls and floors, correct?
It's the Flex RC Owl Storm Edition. And it's a very compact FPV racer, basically, that is kind of designed around indoor flying. It's fairly robust and bounces off objects pretty well without too much damage. The video is very impressive. I particularly like the first part of the video where this drone is flying, this Flex RC is flying inside of a, it looks like a warehouse. Yeah. In between the aisles and up and over and around people and all that at pretty high rates of speed. And there's some kind of a chase drone that's pretty high resolution following it. I thought it was pretty impressive that this pair of drones could stay so close together and navigate this pretty significant obstacle course.
They have better flying skills than we do, don't they?
Absolutely. and then it cuts over to the FPV view from this the lead drone, the Flex RC Owl Storm Edition. So we'll have a link in the show notes to the video and also to the company. Where you can, if you're interested and have the skills, maybe consider this drone.
We have a new segment this week. We do a lot of media partnerships. And if you don't know, please definitely go look at our show notes. There's a lot of conferences out there, and we like to promote our industry. So, but we have two this coming up in October and September. Max, you want to talk a little bit about them?
Yeah, sure. The first is Airborne ISR. That's October 26th and 27th in London. It's a conference that's going to focus on the intelligence chain and best practices that enhance ISTAR capability. So ISTAR, what's ISTAR? ISTAR is Intelligence, Surveillance, Target Acquisition, and Reconnaissance. And if you're interested in that topic, you want to act quickly, there's an early registration discount. The second one is UAV Technology Eastern Europe, and that conference is going to be in Prague, September 21st and 22nd. Both of these, of course, are in 2016. And this conference is aiming to help develop and shape the future capabilities of UAV and airborne system projects in Central and Eastern Europe. Now, many nations are in the really early adoption phase of developing UAS technology and systems, and this is a good event for those who want to get ahead and meet the key decision makers in that region. So you can find out more about these conferences at the UAVDigest.com. There's some more information about the conferences and links to the conference pages as well. So check those out.
And always keep an eye on the website, because we actually do a lot of these conferences over time and media partnerships. And if you do go to the conferences, tell those people that you where you heard it, because Max and I would appreciate the feedback. And, you know, we used to always say on Airplane Geeks, tell your friends. So we'll throw that in here. And speaking of friends, we've got some feedback. The first one was from Dan. Drone over Lambo confiscated by authorities. This is from WBAY.com. Lambo is Lambo Field in Wisconsin, the home of the Green Bay Packers.
Which is a football team for those of you outside the United States. Real football, the real football.
Okay, well, now that you've just offended the rest of the planet.
No, we get hate mail.
American football, yeah. The hate mail should be directed at max at the UAVDigest.com.
Thanks, David.
Evidently, during one of the preseason games, the operator of a drone was flying over the game, which is illegal. It's a no-no. And the FAA is investigating. Now, this guy, ironically, lived in a house across the street from the stadium.
It wasn't too hard to find, I guess, huh?
Well, he was flying in his backyard or front yard. Just happens to be that the stadium is in his front yard. And was kind of shocked that people were upset that he was flying a quadcopter over a sporting event. You know, is it, Max, is it they don't know any better, or just he took the chance? I don't know.
It's hard to say. I think in many of these cases, the operator pleads ignorance and may or may not be ignorant, but we need more awareness of these kinds of bad flying activities, and we need more examples set, like we saw with that guy with the laser pointer shooting at the helicopter.
So the next one came from Tony. Hi, Max and David. Here's an article that may be of interest to you. Drone accidents mostly caused by technical problems, not operator error, research shows. This was from our friends Tony's down in Australia. And this was from abc.net.au, which is the Australian broadcasting company, not the American broadcasting company. And simply put, quadcopters and these things break. Now, we've talked about quality control on a lot of these products and batteries, and the stuff coming from overseas is not necessarily, some of it's really good, some of it is not so good. And when it breaks, things go bad. So this was a good story about faulty equipment. The Australian RMIT, University School of Engineering, looked at 150 reported civilian drone-related accidents around the world over the past decade. 150 over the past decade. That seems like a really long time to be studying drones. Way ahead of the curve. What do you think, Max?
Yeah, it's good. I think they have a good sample size here. Assuming that the causes of failures or reasons for the accidents over that period of time, it remains kind of consistent as opposed to changing over time. But I think that's really interesting that they found that more than half, like you say, 64% of the accidents were, quote, technical problems, which it's not really defined here.
Well, there's a lot that can go break in an aircraft.
Well, sure. Plus, you can lose communications. There's a whole variety of different things. But I just find it very interesting that it's not predominantly caused by people who don't know how to fly properly, or operator error, pilot error, if you will. But it also suggests that, despite the best intentions to make sure that drone operators, drone pilots are qualified, particularly in the commercial arena, we have to look at the robustness of the drones, because that's not being really regulated at this point, right? We don't have certification of aircraft.
Right, and we don't have QC, quality control. Yeah. So it's kind of like hoverboards. There were some good hoverboards, and then there were exploding hoverboards we had last Christmas.
Oh, yeah.
And UAVs are the same thing. There's a lot of quality issues. DJI, of course, makes a quality product, but there's a lot of other aircraft out there, or UAVs out there, that aren't made to those same standards. So, good article. Thanks to Tony and Dan for sending those in. And I'll take this time to say, you too can send us stories at feedback@theuavdigest.com. We like that. We also get our stories from our Slack listener team, which you can find out about on going to theuavdigest.com/team, or just send us an email and we can sign you up for it.
Well, we want to thank all of you for listening to the UAV Digest. We really love the feedback, the interaction. It's really an engaged community, and we enjoy that and hope that you do as much as we do. As always, you can find us at theuavdigest.com. Show notes for this episode are at theuavdigest.com/160. And we're lots of places online as well, in social media.
You can find us on Twitter at UAV Digest. And I'd like to thank everyone who participated in our little survey, whether you're a Starship captain or a pilot or an operator. And the winner was operator. So we'll have to communicate that information over to our favorite dronophobe, Rob Mark.
So, David, you should mention a little bit more about that. So if people haven't seen it yet, David's been running little polls off of our Twitter ID, and a simple, fun, vote for A, B, or C. And is this current one that you're talking about closed now, David?
This one's closed, but we'll have to come up with another one. you can just go to our homepage at Twitter, which is twitter.com/UAV Digest. And I always pin it to the top of the page so you can see it and vote. And they're fun. We've been doing a little bit on Airplane Geeks. It's a way of just getting information out to you guys and finding out whether, you know, maybe the next one we'll talk about is, did you get your 333 or are you waiting for 107? Kind of those kind of simple surveys, or, you know, where's your favorite place to fly your UAV? Do it, just quirky kind of things. They're not supposed to be, they're definitely not scientific, but fun little things to go on. So we'll be doing that. Now, you can always find us on Facebook at facebook.com/UAV Digest. We'd love for you to leave a review on iTunes or Stitcher or Google Play so other people can find us. You can buy some swag. You know, you could always get something that says the UAV Digest on our Cafe Press store. Or you can become a sponsor of the show by going to patreon.com/theUAVDigest. And of course, all of those links are available on the show notes. So with that, I guess I'm getting long-winded, and I will say this is David in Philly.
And Max in Hartford.
As always, thanks for listening.